from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. The enormous explosion in Harlem last Wednesday that killed 8 people and took the homes of many has focused new attention on an aging natural gas infrastructure. From New York to Allentown to Austin, Texas, and beyond, we've got old pipes and big questions. And it's not just our gas infrastructure. From bridges and roads to water lines and schools, we've got a mounting tab that needs attention. This hour on Point, the pipes that bring us gas and the work that needs doing on American infrastructure. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Does your town have a gas main issue you can smell? Are we ducking our infrastructure to-do list? Why? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Last Wednesday, here's one of the residents of the destroyed East Harlem buildings telling WDTV Channel 5 News in New York he and his family smelled gas the evening before that big, deadly blast.
Since last night, we smelled gas in the building. Since last night. And my wife called me, like around 9:30, and the building next door exposed.
And up they went. The next day, Carmen Vargas Rosa told CBS Evening News that she smelled something, gas, the evening before the blast that leveled a church on the ground floor of one of the destroyed buildings in New York.
I smelled gas Tuesday night when we left prayer, but not in the building. So I went into the 116 deli, and I told him, I said, check it out, because it may be from you.
Coming from somewhere, joining me first today from New York is Chris Kirkham, who's been writing about the gas explosion in Harlem for the Huffington Post. Chris, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Good to be with you.
First, what's the latest on death toll and bodies found? Do they have everyone out of the rubble of these buildings, Chris?
They are still searching. The search continued over the weekend, but the death toll has remained the same as it was on Friday, which was at 8. What they're doing now is they're moving into the essentially. I mean, they're trying to determine the cause at this point. So they've done a lot of soil samples over the weekend, and they're continuing to look, trying to get into the basement of the buildings, which is where they're trying to sort of pinpoint what caused the actual, what is suspected to be the gas leak that that may have led to the disaster.
Chris, tell us about the gas mains in that area. I'm reading here that one of them goes back to 1887. It's kind of hard to believe.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, what's very interesting about this when you when you start to look is a lot of older American cities you put in what were called these cast iron gas mains, which this was essentially the material that was available at the time and widely in production, and utilities like Con Edison are going through and sort of replacing these old lines throughout time, but it's sort of a monumental task, particularly in a major city like New York, where replacing a gas main requires you to block off streets and sort of disrupt traffic and potentially even displace people in a neighborhood. So the cast iron mains a lot of experts on pipeline safety have sort of really pointed to these aging lines as it's a major risk factor. And obviously we don't see explosions like this all the time, but there is a disproportionate amount of the risk goes up much higher for these older pipes than the newer materials that are being used now.
Are they talking about trying to do that replacement more quickly? I mean, the latest I'm reading here, they had more than 1,200 miles of that practically ancient cast iron piping in there and weren't scheduled to have it replaced until 2020 or beyond.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, they've through the years, they have, adjusted the schedules of, in terms of the pace of replacing these lines. But, these schedules can stretch if you look at, I think it's the state of Pennsylvania, Philadelphia has a very high number of these cast iron mains sort of beneath its streets. I think the state of Pennsylvania, the estimate for replacing all of the cast iron gas mains there was well into, past 2,100. So we're talking about a long schedule for replacement. And, you know, some of this has to do with, you know, there's a lot of factors, particularly for regulated utilities, in terms of how many expenses you can sort of incur, and then how much those expenses can be passed on to consumers like you and me who are paying rates for the gas. So some of it comes down to regulations, but a lot of it, you know, just comes down to, you know, how much money are we willing to spend and how much of a disruption are we going to sort of cause to the city, you know, in order to sort of pick up the pace of these repairs and updates.
And of course, Chris, there's the issue that that lost gas, many, many billions of cubic feet per year, 60, 70 billion, I think, the cost of that is just passed on to consumers. So it's the gas companies, they lose it, but they don't pay for it. We pay for it.
That's right. Yeah, it's sort of an interesting finding that, you know, some, you know, particularly Ed Markey and Senator from Massachusetts, he's sort of pointed to this in some past reports. The issue that you have with these older lines is that they're much more prone to leaks and, you know, we pay for those leaks. So, you know, if you're watching your meter is going to be going up, yet some of that gas may not be actually... You may not be using it. It may be gas that's just sort of lost.
And if you're really unlucky, it goes up in a ball of flame. It did to a terrible effect last week in New York. Chris Kirkham with the Huffington Post, they're reporting on all this. Thanks very much for joining us, Chris.
Thank you, Phil.
Chris mentioned Pennsylvania, Allentown, Pennsylvania, February 2011. Boom, up went, five people dead, homes destroyed, gas explosion in Allentown. Here was Jawadi Cox talking with the Associated Press about that gas explosion.
I felt it, actually, like a big boom, like maybe it could have, maybe a bomb. I didn't know what it was. As I started recording it, you could like see the fire growing and moving like rapidly.
You may have smelled gas on the street in your town. It would not be unusual in this country. Joining me now from Durham, North Carolina, is Rob Jackson. He's professor of environmental sciences at Duke and Stanford. He's mapped gas leaks in Washington, D.C., Boston, parts of New York. Rob, thank you very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
So is this just an old New York problem or old American city problem? I mean, I see this all the way reaching out to Austin, Texas in a not-so-long-ago report here. How widespread is the issue, Rob?
Well, the issue is widespread, especially in older cities, as you mentioned. Mm-hmm. Philadelphia, New York City, Washington, D.C., and Boston, where we've worked, these are cities that have old infrastructure, in many cases, pipes that are more than a century old. Those situations are where the number of leaks are the greatest.
Is it, you know, people hear a century old and cast iron and, you know, things put in not that long after the Civil War, and you shake your head and think, is this just completely irresponsible, or is it not, Rob? Is this the useful life of these pipes, and, you know, it's reasonable that they're still down there?
It's a difficult question. In a perfect world, a cast iron pipe can last a couple hundred years. I mean, think about a vintage Ford Mustang, you know, the poppy red, my favorite color. Mm. I mean, if you're living in Los Angeles, where it never rains, and you don't have frost, and they don't use road salt,
yep,
and you keep your car in the garage, it's going to last almost forever. But in Chicago or New York, where you've got winter and salt and things corrode, it's not going to last forever. And the pipes under the ground aren't in Hollywood. They're in the real world.
So you went out into the streets, and as if I got it correctly, you drove every street in areas of these cities some kind of sniffer on your vehicle looking for leaks. What did you find?
Well, working with my colleague Nathan Phillips at Boston University,
yes,
and others, we've mapped every block in the city of Boston and just published a paper for Washington, D.C. a couple months ago. We found about 4 leaks per mile on average in both cities, thousands of natural gas leaks in each city. And it interestingly wasn't an issue of rich and poor neighborhoods. It wasn't the case that people in poor neighborhoods were more likely to have problems. It was the case that people in old neighborhoods were likely to have problems.
Is 4 leaks per mile outrageous or reasonable? I have no idea. And how serious is a leak? Is it just a little sniff and not really dangerous, or are we talking 4 danger spots per mile?
Most of those leaks were quite small and probably not dangerous. I mean, it is important to remember that every leak has the possibility or the potential to be dangerous. But really, we worry about the bigger leaks, the higher volume leaks, and especially situations where the natural gas, the methane in the air, can build up in a confined space, like the basement of a building or in a manhole, where we mapped explosive concentrations in D.C. at a dozen locations. So you have a combination of a leak plus a buildup in a confined space. That's the danger.
What constitutes an explosive concentration?
Once you get over about 5% of methane or natural gas in air, that's when it can explode. So distribution companies, the gas companies, have a threshold of about 4%, 40,000 parts per million methane in air. That's what they call a grade one leak. Those are situations where the danger of explosion is very real.
You found 5% methane. You found higher as well.
We found 50% methane in some manholes. Occasionally we'd find a big leak at the street level, and never on the street those kinds of concentrations because the air is mixing with the methane that's leaking out. But at about 20 of the highest concentrations that we saw in D.C., we would hop out of the car and then start sniffing around for where the gas was coming from. So we would put tubes down into manhole covers, look along curbs, punch holes into the soil if we were in a residential neighborhood, and that's where we found these dangerous concentrations.
And if a cigarette or a spark should hit one of those concentrations?
Could go up.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about America's natural gas infrastructure and our broader aging infrastructure after the big explosion last week in Harlem. It's not just in New York City. Here was January 2012. Austin, Texas. Christian Copeland, contractor and friend of a man killed in a gas explosion that leveled his home, told Austin news station KVUE that the man who died had called Texas Gas Service when he smelled gas. The explosion, he said, could have been avoided.
It was completely preventable. He called. He did exactly what he was supposed to do. He called the gas company. He reported it.
We've got lots of leaks in the gas system in this country. Of course, gas systems will have leaks, but when you get too many and they're too big, you can have big trouble. New York saw it just last week. Rob Jackson is with us, professor of environmental sciences at Duke University. He's mapped gas leaks up and down the East Coast. They are not only there. Rob, I don't know if you've looked nationally at the picture here, but the gas companies say, look, we're working on this with public commissions. There's a trade-off here between what you pay for gas and what we repair. We're in a reasonable state overall in this country. Do your findings support that view, Rob?
Yes and no. I think it is really important to give the companies credit for the fact that pipeline safety has improved for the last 20 years in this country. I mean, we have fewer incidents today than we did 20 years ago. So I think that backdrop is interesting when you try and understand why things go wrong and why they don't get fixed. And one of the examples you used earlier, Tom, in the show was the Allentown explosion, where five people were killed a couple years ago. That was an 83-year-old cast iron pipeline. What a lot of people don't know is that pipeline was targeted to be replaced in 1979, more than 30 years earlier, and it was never replaced. It was already a problem then because of leaks. Why not? Why wasn't that pipeline replaced?
That's everybody's question. Judy writes to us, says, we have two gas line leaks on my small suburban street in the last year and a half. Repaired. Several other spots on the street we can smell gas. I've called the gas company. They came and say there's no problem. If you can smell gas walking on a street, does that mean there is a problem, Rob?
Well, if you can smell gas, of course it means there's a problem. The leak may be very small and is likely to be very small, but if you can smell it, it's a leak. I mean, those odorants, those sulfur rotten egg compounds were added to natural gas beginning in about the 1930s after a tragic elementary school explosion that killed hundreds of kids. So the fact that our nose is sensitive to these sulfur compounds doesn't change the fact that if you're smelling gas, there's a leak somewhere.
So what constitutes a must-fix thing? If you can smell it, is that at a point where this needs to be fixed right now? Or if the gas company says, no danger, it's okay, should a resident just accept that?
Well, in the real world, just because you can smell gas doesn't mean that leak would have to be fixed immediately. There are economic reasons for what we do. The companies use a grade scale, three grades. I think I mentioned the grade one leaks earlier. The grade one leaks are the ones that are immediate explosion hazards. And those are usually fixed right away, often the same day once they're identified. Then there's a second category, a grade two, that are lower or smaller but have potential to become grade one. And then there's a grade three leak, which, to be perfectly honest, sometimes can last for years. I can't tell you the number of times when we were mapping natural gas leaks in Boston, for instance, where we'd be working on a street and somebody would step out of a restaurant or a house and say, yeah, I've been calling this natural gas leak in for a couple years.
And it's not fixed because they've determined that it's a small leak or because they just got too many to stay on top of?
Because it's expensive. And this gets to the issue you talked about earlier with Chris. There are a couple of limitations, I think, of economic incentives that are not properly aligned in this case. I mean, first of all, the limits that the companies have on themselves, placed there by the public utility commissions, that's a very real issue. The public utility commissions, their job is to keep costs down for consumers. They keep the prices down that these regulated monopolies pay, and they keep the cost recovery that the companies can charge. So one recommendation that I've made a lot in the last few months is to help the companies front load, get the public utility commissions to allow them to charge more, to recover more costs for fixing pipes earlier on, to accelerate pipeline replacement. But then there's that other misincentive, and that's the fact that consumers pay for $2 billion worth of lost and unaccounted for gas every year in this country. So the companies are often paid for the gas that goes missing. That needs to change too.
If we were to put our, I mean, we've got more infrastructure to talk about, but just stick with natural gas. If we were to put it in ship shape, and that doesn't mean all new, you know, you've got to use the working life of what you install, but to get it in good shape, would it break the bank? Would it be impossible? Would people have gas bills three times what they are now?
Absolutely not. I mean, it would cost billions of dollars, no question about it. We would also save billions of dollars at the same time. So we'd have to do it intelligently. What I would do is target the 100,000 miles of pipes that are the problem spots. So you've got 30,000 miles of old cast iron pipe left in this country. You know, replace that, sleeve it with a smaller plastic pipe inside, do all kinds of things to take that line out of commission. You don't always have to dig up a mile of street in New York. You know, that's $1 million to replace that. So there are a lot of things that we can do that won't break the bank, but we will have to invest some money up front. And I think for me, that's a key message. You know, there's a sweet spot here that crosses party lines and personal motivations. I mean, by fixing these leaks, we can save lives and money. We can improve air quality and we can even help the environment. Everybody wins.
I don't know if anything crosses party lines exactly anymore. I mean, interest rates have never been lower than they've been in the last half dozen years, and that would have made it cheap to put the money up front, and we haven't done it. Let me get our callers in. David in Jamaica Plain, Massachusetts. David, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
How are you?
Good. What do you know?
Well, I feel like I'm boots on the ground here. I've had some personal experience with this, which was pretty much mirrors what your guest is speaking of. Jamaica Plain, an old neighborhood of Boston. My house is 100 years old.
Yeah.
And the pipeline, the gas pipeline, is probably about the same. For years, smelt gas pretty consistently in the winter when the temperature went down to zero or so. Called the gas company. They come out. They put a probe in. Nothing came of it. Fast forward to, about 10 years ago, and they replaced the gas main. I happened to be around when they did it and was sort of curious. Watched them excavate the main right in front of my house. The T that came off the main to my house literally fell off when they removed the soil around it.
The T joint in the pipe it just crumbled.
Yeah, it literally fell off. In fact, the crew that was doing the work, I asked for the T as a memento.
Jeez, yeah. Of how close you came to glory.
Well, yeah. I mean, the thing that concerned me was the ability of gas to creep along the corridor created by the pipe. You know, it can go right into your basement and infiltrate that way. But
if we were to fix all this up, David, and it were to mean some portion higher gas rates for some time, what would you say about that?
Well, another personal experience that I had, less close to home, but I grew up in New Jersey outside of New York City. As a child of, I don't think I was 10 years old. I remember driving by a house that had a gas leak, and the house was literally leveled. It was splinters.
I guess when it comes to that, we would be willing to pay something to avoid that kind of fate. David, thank you very much for your call. I appreciate it. Let me get one more, if I may. Stay safe, David. Bob in Burlington, Vermont. Bob, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
It's my understanding that, and I could be wrong, that methane and natural gas is a far more potent greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide. And if we're releasing all these billions of cubic feet into the atmosphere, would that affect the climate change issue, number one? And number two, wouldn't that allow the EPA to regulate it as a pollutant?
Interesting questions, both. Bob, thank you for your call. Rob Jackson, how about it? We're told natural gas is far cleaner than, let's say, coal. But then coal doesn't float up, into the atmosphere until you burn it. Natural gas can leak out anywhere. What about methane versus CO2 and its environmental damage?
There's a tremendous amount of work being done right now trying to understand the full greenhouse gas consequences of this. So first of all, let's step back. And when we burn coal, we generate particulates and sulfur dioxide and mercury. These are things that kill people. Mm-hmm. So there is no question that burning natural gas, replacing electricity generation, replacing coal for gas is a win in terms of air quality.
Air quality. But when we go to greenhouse gas, what about it? Factor in all the loss, the leakage?
So that's a tougher question. At the power plant level, it's also clear that there are fewer carbon dioxide emissions with a natural gas plant than with a coal plant. Where we're trying to work now, and I work on this personally, both at the well pad level and at the street level, is to try and understand what the total leakage is of methane all the way from that first drilling in the ground to when a consumer uses the gas. And right now, it still looks like there's a net climate benefit. That's my take on the literature.
To using gas instead of coal, even with the leakage, but not as much as what? Sorry.
But not as much as we would have thought 5 years ago. And so that's where there have been a couple of recent studies showing that overall, regionally, the gas leakage looks higher from oil and gas operations than we expected. I'd like to point out, though, that these are issues, in my view, that are easier to fix than some of the issues with coal. And I think that's an important message for people. Even if the leak rates are relatively high, it's a lot easier to solve those kinds of problems than it is to solve problems with, coal ash spills like we've just had here in North Carolina.
Yeah. So of course, you actually have to do the fixing for that
that's
formula
right.
to make sense, and do it on a scale that's comparable to the challenge, to the problem. Rob Jackson, stand by there in Durham, North Carolina. It's great to have you with us. Rob has driven up and down and all around tracking natural gas leaks, and he has found a lot of them. It looks like that's where they're headed when they are looking for the reason for the big explosion in East Harlem last week. We've got infrastructure issues all around the block here. With us right now from Washington is Robert Puentes, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution at the Metropolitan Policy Program there, heads up the Infrastructure Initiative. Robert Puentes, thank you very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
In terms of the scale of challenge, when you look at our natural gas infrastructure, aging gas mains and all the rest, how does it stack up as an infrastructure challenge, as opposed to water and sewerage systems or roads and bridges or schools or airports, Robert?
Well, I think you're right that we've got to separate infrastructure into these different categories. We've talked about infrastructure in the abstract, and it almost has this kind of cartoony version, but we know, as you're kind of laying out, that infrastructure is made up of a bunch of interrelated sectors as diverse as a water treatment plant is from an airport or a wind farm or a broadband network or a gas line. So to talk about infrastructure, we have to think about it that way. And I think it's clear that broadly we've underinvested in infrastructure for decades in this country. We know that as a share of U.S. GDP, we invest about 2.4% in the U.S., while the figure for Europe is close to 5%. And then crazy numbers like 9-12% in places like China. So broadly, we know that we have a lot of work to do. To assess exactly how much we should be spending, though, is the big challenge. Clearly, safety is paramount, right? And if we have things like the tragedy in Harlem, if we have things like the bridge collapsing in Minneapolis, These are things that have to be addressed immediately, and they have a very different sense of urgency behind them for obvious reasons. But after that, you know, it is, we do have these daily reminders just that the condition that infrastructure is in now, and whether it comes from potholes on the streets or the freight network and accommodating larger ships and things like this, we've got to think about it in terms of what all this means then for economic growth going forward. Once we deal with all the challenges around safety and the immediate maintenance challenges, what then do we need to put together for an American economy that's going to compete in the 21st century?
Robert Puentes, in Washington, I think a lot of people have the sense that somehow we've just we're just forfeiting here. We're sort of ducked out of the infrastructure improvement game, that other countries are pushing ahead and we're falling behind. Why is that?
Well, I think these big numbers kind of lead you that way. Again, when you look at a place like China, when you look at Japan, when you look at Western Europe, you wonder why these places look different from their built environment than we have here in the U.S. You know, but we know that particularly when it comes to the public infrastructure investments, the things that the federal government has paid attention to for, you know, we have crazy partisan division and rancor in Washington right now. That's as bad as anybody's ever seen it. So taking bold action to reinvest in our nation's infrastructure, you know, for the foreseeable future is going to be a challenge. It should be one of those things that's not only bipartisan, but nonpartisan.
You know, but we're hung up on that, and both parties want a healthy economy. So dig into that a little more deeply. I mean, we're getting a D+. Now, this is from American Society of Civil Engineers. Of course, the infrastructure repair is good for them, but still, that D+, that's just a hair above F. What's changed in the outlook that would make this okay for any party if this is the basis for economic growth?
I think the big challenge that we haven't really articulated that fundamental connection between infrastructure and economic growth. We've always thought about infrastructure as infrastructure of itself, right?
And that, but people know that. They've known it since we built the railroads. That was a huge investment, but everybody knew that that would open up the country for economic growth. It's not mysterious.
But we've forgotten. I think the challenge is that we've forgotten, we've moved away from it, and it's become connected to something like just short-term job creation, which we obviously needed a few years ago, but then that connection to larger economic goals. So we had a big national goal to double exports in 5 years to take advantage of rising global demand. That should then lead you to very specific investments in the freight network, for example, expanding ports, looking at pinch points in certain places, connections to the freight rail network and the truck rail network. That should be part and parcel of the larger economic goal. If we're trying to connect low-income workers to jobs, for example, that has a lot of things to do with skills and things like that, but it also has to do with understanding where they live, how are they getting to work, and then what are the transportation connections to do that. So when infrastructure is derivative of the economic goals, then you can really move something. If it's just a conversation about infrastructure, which unfortunately is what we've had, it's very tough to move things.
Robert, when you travel around the world, I mean, many Americans, you know, we live here. We live at home, and we see what we see right in front of us here. But if you travel and come home, how's it look, our infrastructure?
Depends on where you're coming from. I mean, if you
developed the world, anywhere east or west.
To JFK, you can see, you know, you wonder which one is the emerging economy and which one is the established, you know, world leader. So things like airports and high-speed rail, these things get a lot of attention because it's the connections that we make in these different countries. But we'd have a lot of infrastructure to be proud of here in the U.S., particularly things that are privately invested, the freight rail network, telecommunications, all these things, the things that the private sector has led for years, actually are in pretty good shape. It's things that where we had public sector investment for a long time, which, again, world-class infrastructure has not been maintained, hasn't been kept up.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we are talking this hour about America's natural gas infrastructure and our broader aging infrastructure after the big explosion in Harlem last week. 8 dead there. 2 good-sized buildings just brought down. Pipes, water, gas mains nearby, some of them 120-plus years old. Rob Jackson is with us, professor of environmental sciences at Duke and Stanford universities. He has mapped gas leaks up and down in this country and very recently found them and found that they're still there when he comes back in many cases. Robert Puentes joins us from Washington, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. He directs the Metropolitan Infrastructure Initiative there. Jenny in Asheville, North Carolina. Jenny, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi. I guess have a comment, a couple comments. First of all, if there was an easy answer, obviously the problem would have been solved by now. So there are no easy answers, but it's very upsetting to see that, you know, it seems we could prevent a lot of these natural disasters that have been, not natural disasters, actually, you know, energy disasters that have been happening around the country, in Harlem recently, in West Virginia, in North Carolina, in Asheville. We had something very recent. And, you know, why are these companies, they're presented with a problem, they have a way to prevent the problem, and we have to wait until there's a huge disaster until we actually, you know, do something about it. I just want to know why these companies aren't being held responsible to take care of problems they have the power and money to solve.
Jenny, we'll circle back into that, and I appreciate your call. Let me get one more, and we'll come to it. Jim in Spencer, Iowa. Jim, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Tom. You know, all these utility companies, they have these programs where they want to come out and help us save nickels and dimes on our utility bills, you know, with a little extra insulation and a little caulk here and there.
Yeah.
Well, this is really, you know, an incentive program that I think the taxpayers support. But, you know, where's their incentive? You know, they pump this stuff out of the ground. It's part of our national asset, and they're wasting it.
Yeah, that's right? we're taping up our window, taping plastic over the windows while it's just coming right up out of the ground. Rob Jackson, let me bring both of those to you, and maybe we should come back into this dynamic around gas utilities and these repairs again. What would it take to shift the incentives or the requirements so that we would have a better natural gas infrastructure, Rob?
Well, I think it's important to, you know, to point out that the people working for these companies care deeply about safety and they care about their jobs. So again, I think the issue is, why is there a mismatch sometimes between what people want to do and what they can do sometimes? So an event like Harlem is exceedingly rare, right? It's like throwing dice, and the dice have to come up snake eyes over and over and over again for that to happen. So if you don't do anything, the chances are that nothing's going to happen. So we have to overcome that, and some ways to do that would be, for instance, federal loan guarantees, which we've done in some other areas.
To the utilities?
Yes, to guarantee cost recovery for the companies, to help them invest to speed up the replacement and the repair of these pipelines. That's part of one of the bills that Senator Markey has introduced in the Senate over the last couple of months.
Why would they need that? I mean, they charge for the gas, so they have a clear means of repaying loans. Why do they need a federal loan guarantee?
Well, that's just one example. The key thing, though, is what we talked about earlier, and that's the limitations that the companies have, the caps on what they can charge to do this kind of work. We have to free that cap up. And there are some programs already in place around the country. New Hampshire has just successfully, I believe, completed a program to replace all of its cast iron pipe. We have to get creative in the incentives we provide. And there is a role, I think, for the feds not to get deeply involved, but to provide some incentives, some loan guarantees, some other things for doing that. That's what has to happen.
Robert Puentes, what would you prescribe in the natural gas infrastructure front? Gas, we'll look beyond that. But how would you change, tweak the system so that these repairs get made?
I think there is something that we can learn from other areas of infrastructure, even though these things are separate. But we do see that this closer relationship between the public and the private sector, and they're all very idiosyncratic in what's happening with natural gas utilities and with the oversight and the regulation, right, is different from other areas. But when we see that there is a closer connection between the sharing of risks and rewards between these entities, we can see the private sector maybe making those kinds of investments, because then they're incentivized to do so. For all the reasons that Rob just mentioned, you know, it's rare when these tragedies kind of happen. But keeping the infrastructure up to a certain standard can be built into these contracts. They can be organized at the front. We're going through a very transitioning time here when we think about our infrastructure. I think what's going to emerge is this closer relationship between the public and the private sector, and a clear articulation of what these conditions need to look like at the end of the day.
I mean, I think I and a lot of Americans worry that we just get used to a gradually diminishing quality or state of repair, and we look around and we don't always even see it as a problem anymore. Even when you can see the trouble right in front of your face, we come to think, well, this is just the way it is. Jeannie in Hinsdale, New Hampshire. Jeannie, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Hi. Yeah, this segues really good into why I called. I'm afraid I'm going to go over into the bridge infrastructure topic.
Yep.
I live in Hinsdale, which borders on the Connecticut River between Brattleboro, Vermont. And there are two very, very old bridges that people have to cross over to get from Vermont to New Hampshire.
And it's a good-sized river right there.
It is. It is. And semi-trucks have to come over, 18-wheelers,
yep,
and all kinds of heavy traffic because there's a Walmart over here. And what happened was these bridges, I believe, they were built in the 1930s. And about a year ago, a local resident of Hinsdale became very concerned, looking at the bridges himself, that they were so rusted and old and very unsafe to travel over. And he used to stand on the bridge with signs and wearing a halo on his head and all kinds of things to get people aware of the fact that these bridges were no longer safe.
Yeah.
And I actually stopped one day, and he personally showed me underneath, you know, the rust. And you really got scared looking at how old they were. There has been talk about putting a new bridge over the river, but money is always the issue, and issues between the state of Vermont and New Hampshire. But sad to say, my point is, after several months of this protest, the man was eventually arrested and fined and told to never appear on the bridge again.
So that was the answer, rather than fix the bridge, take away the guy pointing it out?
Yeah, yeah. And there were articles in the newspaper, but every time I go over these bridges, I say a prayer. Because we know that bridges have collapsed in other part of the country.
Of course, we saw it in Minnesota. Down they went.
Right.
Jeannie, good luck there. We'll think of that halo and say a prayer as you go over. Let me get one more right here, if I may. Jeannie, thank you. Sam in Boston. Sam, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to make a question real quick. Why is it that we have been focusing so much on growth over maintaining the basic systems that we are all so heavily reliant on? It seems to me that when it comes to a basic economy, what you want to do is focus on the main infrastructure and be able to keep that infrastructure going at a pace that would be just overall beneficial to the entire society.
Yeah, it just seems like basic logic. I'm not sure that's in contradiction with growth. I mean, that's what supports economic activity. Robert Puentes, this comes back to you. There's Jeannie, you know, saying a prayer when she goes over the bridge every day. And this bigger question we come back to, I mean, I've got lots of listeners online. Here's one says, infrastructure rot is going to become an unmanageable expense. Here's another says, the richest nation in history of the world can't afford to repair its crumbling infrastructure. People are just confused why we would let this happen, Robert.
I'm as confused as anybody. I'll tell you, I think that it's tough to hear Jeannie's point. I think that guy should stay on the bridge and should keep calling attention to things like this. We had a transit shutdown or a potential transit shutdown in Atlanta, and they put big red X's on the buses to illustrate, to show people what's going to happen if transit cuts go in. So I think we have to keep amplifying these points, and people need to speak out. And they need to let folks know that reinvesting in the existing system is just as important, if not more important, than investing in new infrastructure in many cases. As the caller just said, we have a lot of folks who will complain that they need something fixed and they want a new piece of infrastructure to fix that. There's just not that many people calling for, you know, reinvesting in the existing infrastructure.
We hear a lot about our national fiscal situation, debt and so forth.
We spend a lot of money on infrastructure, though, right? But we've got to make sure that it's spent in the right cases. And keeping the existing system, obviously, safe is first fundamentally most important.
Well let's dig into that. We spend a lot of money. Is it spent well? Is it spent efficiently? Are we somehow blowing money that we earmark for infrastructure repair?
It's hard to say we're blowing it, but I think that, again, we need to make sure that, so even you look at just that bridges, when the American Society of Civil Engineers did their report card, and they laid out all these different areas, and bridges is the one area that has been called to the national attention because of the tragedy. It has one of the highest grades, C+, not a great grade, but that's one of the highest grades from all these other areas. Energy is a D+, you know, waterways are a D-, roads are a D. So the question is not whether or not we're building the new stuff the right way, but where that balance is, and how do we invest in new infrastructure to keep the nation competitive, but also make sure that we're not having these tragedies happen with shocking regularity.
We heard a lot of talk when the economy fell off a cliff about some big spending that would both create jobs but also maybe retool our infrastructure for this century's economy. And we'd be the spiffy country with the good infrastructure that the economic growth could come on top of. What happened to that effort, Robert Puentes?
Well, I think the challenge then, it was the right idea. We had to put people back to work. We needed to, and infrastructure is a great way to do that, but that had to be done quickly, right? All the stuff around shovel-ready projects was the right thing because we had to make sure that things weren't going to be languishing for years. It takes a long time to get some of this new stuff built. And when you look at what was on the books and what transportation departments and other groups had ready, it was a lot of this rehab stuff. And so we did actually spend a lot of that money on the mundane stuff, on the pothole fillings and the bridge repaintings. And that was probably necessary stuff to do, but this is what happened. When that money was gone, people looked and said, well, where was this new infrastructure we were promised? Well, these were the repairs that had to be done. This was the stuff that was shovel-ready and was ready to do for the books. And then you have things like high-speed rail, which was a big presidential national initiative, and that's been languishing for a long time. So, there's this push and pull and this inconsistency between the demand for making sure that what we have on the ground is in functioning condition, and then this demand for all this new stuff, which is very expensive, very hard to get through the pipeline.
And meanwhile, a lot of just the degradation with age goes on. Mike, in Madison, Wisconsin. Mike, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. My concern is overinvestment in technology, this kind of technology. I would only fix the very large emissions of methane that are causing global warming, and those that are a threat to safety, and leave the other ones go, because I think we're going to have solar and wind energy to replace natural gas eventually.
So don't pour a whole lot of money into a fuel that you hope to see sidelined eventually. Mike, thanks for your call. Rob Jackson, how about that view of the natural gas infrastructure problem?
Well, I think there is some wisdom to being thoughtful about how we, what we target for our repairs, targeting large leaks, obviously targeting leaks that are dangerous. But I don't think it's an either or situation. We just have to be smart about spending money. I mean, I think of this as like maintaining your house. I mean, you can postpone maintenance and repairs on your house year after year and save money doing it. Save money in the short term, but eventually the bill comes due, and usually the bill is a lot bigger than if you had maintained the house properly all along. That's the message that the politicians need to hear.
What about new technology coming in that might make these infrastructure repairs or rebuildings in your field, Rob, better or cheaper? Because, is there a possibility of that?
I think there is a very real possibility of scientific advances. I mean, the number one goal of my work in this area is to try and provide information to improve things, to help things be better and to be useful. So there are new cameras that are being developed, infrared cameras that allow us to find leaks. I think the situation is very similar at leaking well pads. Over 90% of the well pads are pretty clean, and then once in a while you see ones with enormous leaks. And so we need ways to identify the leaking areas quicker. There are new sensors like we put into cars and things, new sensors for airplanes. So there's a lot going on in this area. I think this is a problem that we can tackle.
One more call. Don in Burlington, Vermont. Don, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I'm Don Gilbert. I'm president and CEO of a gas company up in Burlington. We serve all of Vermont. And we've taken the lead to replace all of our old bare steel and cast iron piping. It's been a great thing. I think it's something we should do. I'm pleased the regulators up here in Vermont have allowed us to do that.
You replaced all of it? Why did it break the bank? How did the money work out, Don?
No, we did it over time. We started many years ago, and we started to replace it a little bit each year, and by the mid-90s, we replaced all of it.
I mean, lots of people are doing a little bit each year. Do you think they need to pick up the pace if they haven't got it replaced by this point?
Well, I think the important thing is to get started and make sure that you are replacing it and to prioritize the most important areas to address. But we've done it, and it's been a great success.
Hey, Don, yeah, I was curious about that. This cast iron, some of it's lasted for 100-plus years now. Now it's leaking plenty, I guess. But plastic is going in there. What's the expectation on how long that will last, Don?
Well, if it's maintained, it can last way out in the future, even beyond that time frame.
That's good news. I'm glad you got a bunch replaced up there, and thank you for your call, Don. Robert Puentes, if people want to talk to congressmen of whatever party about this, what's the message do you think Congress needs to hear if Americans want to say, come on, let's fix it up?
First, I would not go to Congress. I would try with maybe some of the local representatives and maybe on the state level. I think that the conversation in Washington is strained right now. I think you'll have much more progress working with folks on the ground and having that add up to more of a big national conversation. A top-down federal approach, I just don't think is going to be very fruitful right now. But you know, if you wanted to go that way, I think they need to hear that these things are happening in congressional districts all across the country. I don't think you probably can't look at one and say that, well, this one's perfectly fine. We don't need to do anything there. This is a national challenge. It has very local effects, but when you, and it has to be real. So when you talk about the bridge in Vermont, or you talk about the pipes in San Francisco, or whatever the case is, those things have to be made real and tangible for folks to understand. That would be as specific as possible.
And let's not just borrow against our kids and grandkids having to fix it all up when it's really collapsing around their ears. Robert Puentes with the Brookings Institution Infrastructure Initiative there. Robert, thank you very much for joining us today. Great to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
And Rob Jackson, who drove all over to find those gas leaks at Duke University. Rob Jackson in Durham, North Carolina. Thank you for joining us today, Rob.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for being here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.